going to start with business combinations under common control. I give the floor to Julia.
Thank you very much, Hans. Good morning. Over the past few months, the board discussed information needs of various types of primary users in business combinations under common control. The board discussed whether business combinations under common control are all the same. We have also discussed those topics extensively with various board consultative groups, and the feedback we received from those groups is summarized in Agenda Paper 23A. So far, the board has decided to use the acquisition method in IFRS 3 as a starting point for analyzing transactions that affect non-controlling shareholders. The board also decided that it need not pursue a single approach for all transactions within the scope of the project. At this meeting, we would like to ask the board to decide whether and when a current value approach based on the acquisition method should apply to transactions within the scope of the project, and whether and when a predecessor method should apply. Before I tee up the paper, I would like to make a couple of general high-level observations. First of all, as the board has already discussed, there is an important interaction between whether and when a particular approach is applied and how that approach is applied. For that reason, we already discussed with the board in July an overview of how a current value approach and a predecessor approach could apply, and of the key questions the board would need to consider in deciding how those approaches should apply. After today's discussion, we plan to present an analysis of how each of the approaches should apply in October, November, and December board meetings, and also discuss what information should be disclosed in the notes. Secondly, I would like to remind the board that the decisions we ask you to make today relate to preliminary view to be set out in a future discussion paper. Even though the discussion paper will set out a preliminary view, we still expect that we will explain in that discussion paper other approaches and why the board does not propose other approaches. And finally, just to remind the board that in this project we are looking at the receiving entity and at the information needs of primary users of the receiving entity financial statements. We are not looking at the controlling party, and we are not looking at primary users of financial statements of the controlling party. With that, I move to Agenda Paper 23A. There are three questions for the board. Do you agree that a single approach should not be required for all transactions within the scope of the project? Do you agree with the staff recommendation on when a current value approach should be applied? And do you agree that a predecessor approach should be applied for all the remaining transactions within the scope of the project? I'd like to quickly tee up the whole paper, but we would like the board to take the questions one by one. On balance, we think that a single approach should not be required for all transactions within the scope of the project. This is for two reasons. First of all, we think that business combinations under common control are not all the same. We think that some of them are more akin to a regular business combination in the scope in IFRS 3, and therefore similar information should be provided, whereas other business combinations are different, and therefore different information should be provided. The second reason is that we think that a composition of primary users in a business combination under common control would affect the conclusion about what results in most useful information at a cost justified by the benefits of that information. The question then becomes when a current value approach and when a predecessor approach should be applied. The board has already decided to use the acquisition method as a starting point for transactions that affect non-controlling shareholders, and many stakeholders, although not all, agree with such a starting point. They agree that the current value approach based on the acquisition method would provide most useful information to non-controlling shareholders at a cost justified by the benefits. They also agree that a presence of non-controlling shareholders in the receiving entity suggests that the transaction is similar to a business combination that is not under common control. It's similar to an acquisition. And that is especially the case if NCI is substantive. We further considered whether a current value approach should be required for all transactions that affect non-controlling shareholders or only some such transactions. conceptual framework reminds us that the board needs to consider cost constraint, and the board needs to consider whether the usefulness of information is justified by the cost. We think that for listed entities, the cost constraint would not be an obstacle. This is because in many cases there are minimum listing requirements, and therefore NCI will be substantive enough. However, we think that cost constraint could be an obstacle in some circumstances for privately held entities. And therefore, we think that the board should explicitly consider and address cost constraint in its proposals in relation to private entities. We do not recommend a quantitative threshold for private entities, either expressed as a number or expressed in a qualitative way, such as de minimis. Instead, we recommend an exemption for private entities which would permit them to provide predecessor information if non-controlling shareholders do not object. In addition, we also recommend excluding private entities from the requirement to provide current value information if all non-controlling shareholders are related parties. And just a couple of concluding remarks before I hand it over to the board. Of course, our proposed recommendation does not provide an ideal solution for providing useful information justified by the cost is justified by the benefit in all circumstances. And we do not think that any ideal solution exists. We think that every approach would come with its benefits and its drawbacks. However, having considered various possibilities that are outlined in the agenda paper 23A, we think that our proposed recommendation provides a good balance between benefits and costs. And finally, I would also like to remind the board that in practice today, predecessor method is most commonly applied for business combinations under common control, although the acquisition method is also applied, and the predecessor method is a required approach in some jurisdictions. Therefore, if the board were to require current value approach in particular circumstances, that would result in a change in practice. With that, I would like to hand it over to the board.
Sorry, do you want to discuss all three questions or one by one?
We would like to definitely vote one by one. So maybe if we first discuss whether it should be a single approach, different, but...
Okay, so just question one at this point. Yeah. Yan Chao.
Thank you, Hans. Yeah, just question one. Actually, when I look at the question, I feel a little bit difficult to answer this question because that said that we should not propose a single approach. I think if we look at other standards, if the transaction is similar or same, the board intention try to develop a single approach to reduce the divergence in practice, to enhance the compatibility. So I'm struggling to answer this question because I think our objective is try to propose a single approach for if those transactions, the nature of transaction is similar or same. I think this is our objective. And secondly, maybe there is an exception, as maybe in some circumstances there is exceptions. If this is the case, first we should develop so-called general model, and then develop some additional accounting treatment for, you know, for those exceptions. I think this is a very reasonable approach to approach this project. Otherwise, we have to decide what kind of bright line we should have. And maybe we have no, you know, sound basis for different approaches. And we should decide, just like question two and question three, in which circumstances we should apply one approach, in which circumstances we should apply another approach. Even the nature of the transaction is exactly the same. Why we need different approaches? So I'm struggling. You know, I think first we should priority. We should try our best to develop single approach, and then if there is a special circumstances and then provide some exception, I think it's very reasonable way to approach this project. Yeah.
Okay. Julia wants to answer.
Unless you have a comment.
I was going to comment partly on the single approach mm-hmm. argument. And I know that Jing Chao might not agree with the way that I would argue it, but I think it's a perspective, and I think it might be the way that the staff has been thinking about it, which is that arguably the only way we could have a single approach would be to require the current method for everything, for all business combinations under common control, because then it would make it the same single method that we require for other business combinations, and I'm not sure that's what you would want the result to be. So I think if any line is drawn that means that there's some approach that isn't current accounting in some circumstances, we by definition don't have a single approach for business combinations. Yes. In response to question one, though, for the board, I think that for me is the easiest of the questions. I agree with the staff's recommendation that there shouldn't be, that we shouldn't propose a single approach to all transactions, and that we should make it the case that in some circumstances, and we'll get on to what circumstances, there should be a predecessor type approach. Not least because of the situations that we've found, such as where there might not be a change in the sort of equity interests held by the shareholders because they've got interest in different pieces of parts of the group, or where you have just debt investors that are the external investors in the receiving entity, where they've told us that they don't really have a, you know, very particular need for current value information. So I think there's some circumstances where we're able to make an assessment about the cost benefit, for example, that would mean that we'd be comfortable in those circumstances to say we'll do something different to what IFRS 3 would require. And to achieve that, I think the answer to question one for me therefore has to be yes, I agree with the recommendation.
I think we expect suppose that we do what you propose here, then you would still expect the big majority of business combinations under common control to be accounted for using the predecessor method, right?
All transactions between wholly owned entities would fall under predecessor.
I have some sympathy for Jen Chao's reasoning, and also for the acceptability of the proposals, where people are anxious about this. It would be, from the beginning, be very good to communicate that we expect that for most cases predecessor method will be the right answer, except for those cases where common control is less than total, right? and that in certain circumstances you would be led to the acquisition method. So communication-wise, I think Jen Chao's approach is not so bad.
Except that I think what Jing Chao was meaning was that arguably all business combinations under common control should have one method, and that method could be the predecessor method. And that is one approach as opposed to two approaches. But that's assuming that your population you're comparing is just BCUCC as opposed to all acquisitions. I agree that I'd answer yes to question one, but then I would also agree to yes to other proposals in this paper, which would mean that in a lot of cases you would get predecessor method, and that's fine from a signalling perspective. But I was just trying to answer the straightforward first, which is basically, do you agree that some should be predecessor and some should be current within this population?
Yeah, but Jen Chao is afraid it's a bit of a trick question. And
I also paused over this question, thinking about what you're actually asking us, and I think you're asking us, do we recognise that proceeding there are going to be two methods in operation? So when I approached the question, I thought about how often we start from one model. Jun Cho, when he talks about a single model, so often we start from one model, but then we make allowance for some other arrangement because that works for cost-benefit considerations or something else. And if I wanted to start with one model here, I'd struggle to start with predecessor because of IFRS 3 and the acquisition method.
So if I wanted to start with one model, I feel like I would be starting with acquisition method, and then I would be very quickly recognising this huge population which will be using predecessor method. So as I look at your question, my answer will be yes, I will support the staff position, but I'm just wondering, I know we're not on question two, I think things get clearer in question two, but I just wondered about what you really wanted us to think about here. Did you really want us to recognise that you can see these two models operating, whereas the way I approached it, I approached it thinking, well, there's one model and then there's going to be all these exceptions, which are just going to be very large in this case.
I think conceptually we as staff is sort of in a similar position as you articulated and Sue articulated. I think there is a general model to Chinchao's point. The general model is a current value approach, but then we recognize that some business combinations under common control are not similar to the remaining population of business combinations, and therefore a different approach would be more appropriate for those remaining transactions. This is how we think about it.
For business combinations, generally,
yes.
Yes. The answer.
Yeah.
But here we're talking about a subset. Yeah. Business combinations are common control, and our expectation is the majority will be predecessor method, right? Or not?
I don't think we can make a quantitative assessment how often non-controlling shareholders are involved in those transactions and how often they are not involved. But what we do know is that all transactions that involve wholly owned entities, you know, are combinations made to optimize operational structure or optimize the group's tax position, things like that. So all transactions between wholly owned entities will be under the predecessor method, under our proposals, and also some transactions that affect non-controlling shareholders or private entities, if in those particular cases non-controlling shareholders do not object. So I think overall it's a significant population, but we cannot make a quantitative assessment.
No, but you have some expectation, no?
Well, at least be some. And that's what question one's trying to acknowledge.
Yeah. Daryl?
So I agree with where the staff landed. I agree with Anne and Sue's comments that if one method was the method, I think it would be the acquisition method throughout. And so what we're now already talking about is where we draw the line there. And for me, thinking about question one, I simply thought about the two extremes. And the one extreme is the one that we've touched on a little bit, which is the extreme of 100% owned subsidiary, nobody else really looking at the accounts necessarily. Is the cost benefit, is there a benefit in that circumstance, given that the cost for that entity is likely to be exactly the same as the cost for any other entity applying it? So that would be my one extreme example. On the other extreme, and just to remind people, because I think we lose sight of this sometimes, it's entirely possible that an entity under common control can itself be a listed entity. And so when I think about that circumstance where the entity under common control that is the acquisition acquiring entity is a listed entity in itself, then in that circumstance it seems that people would come to that set of financial statements expecting the same reporting as everybody else does. And in that circumstance, it seems I've got the other extreme. So if I just consider those two without thinking about where to draw the line, it feels to me like we need two different sets of two different approaches, and I'm therefore comfortable with the recommendation in question one.
Mary?
Really easy to be wise after the fact, but I now kind of wish that question one was question three, in the sense of let's, you know, discuss the characteristics of certain transactions for which I think you were raising questions about the cost benefit of the existing business combinations approach, which is a current value approach. And I see why you put it first, but as I said, easy to be wise after the fact. But I do think it's important in our messaging that we say we have a single model for business combinations, and now what we're trying to do is identify the population for which that is not cost beneficial, rather than the other way around. And the reason I say that...
In practice, we don't have a...
No, we do
model.
For business combinations.
Yes. Yeah.
All, you know...
Yeah,
My gut, Hans, is thinking ahead to questions two and three and the characteristics. For all the kind of administrative reorganizations that involve putting together companies under common control where there are no NCI. You're right, that, and I think that's a large volume, but I don't have the data to say that that's the large volume. I'm being cautious, okay?
No, but you were saying we currently have one single approach, but I don't think that's the reality.
IFRS 3
in terms of what we require
is the requirement for business combinations. And what is, if I think about business combinations under common control, is the defining characteristic of those transactions that they're a business combination or that they're under common control? And when I think about, and if you think about it, the business combinations accounting standard is the only standard for which we have an exception that's based on the fact that, that the parties involved are under common control. There's no exception to any other standard that says, but if you have transactions involving parties under common control, don't apply this. So to me, that says that the primary characteristic of these transactions is that they're business combinations. And in, you know, in the past, when the board did IFRS 3, it said, well, there are other issues associated with a subpopulation of these because of common control. Let's park that. But we don't create exceptions anywhere else. And so we're going back to clean up this puddle, which is why I say I agree with the comments that Sue, Ann, and Daryl made about in principle, we have a single method in IFRS 3 for accounting for business combinations. Long ago, we used to have two, and here's when you did one, and here's when you did the other. But, since IFRS 3, we have one method. And then the question is there a population for which this one method doesn't provide cost-beneficial information? And, Hans, like you, I think when it's under common control and it's all the transactions, the legal shuffling that maybe rationalizes structures or something like that, that may be a big volume. And yes, I don't want to go through fair value exercises for those transactions. It's peeking ahead to questions 2 and 3, but I think I want to communicate that the critical shared characteristic is that it's a business combination. And the other thing I don't want to lose sight of is, I think that current value accounting for every transaction would provide some useful information because it would tell anybody using those financial statements whether there was a value transfer between the two legal, between the entities. And if you use a predecessor method, you don't know if the building that's being transferred from company A to company B is actually quadrupled in value. And but I think, and if there is no value transfer, being told that by the fact that there's current value accounting. So I think that is a benefit that would be present in every transaction, but I think the staff has made an argument that in the cases in which there's not, looking ahead to questions 2 and 3, certain characteristics, users who have an interest have other ways of getting that information, if they're concerned, and the cost benefit of imposing the requirement isn't there. So then I come back and answer question one, not because I set out wanting to have two models, but because I know what you're analyzing in 2 and 3 in terms of the exception to the current value model.
Nick?
First of all, really thank you to the staff, because I think this is a nice paper that pulled together all of the deliberations that we've had over the last few months that I found very helpful. Just to quickly pick up while I remember what Mary just said, I'm not sure that current value accounting does always illustrate value transfers. And also, it may be an indication, but it doesn't tell you the complete picture. So I have some reservations about that. Going back to where we started with Jen Chow's concerns about, here we're going to have two models here. I think it's important to differentiate between having more than one model and offering an accounting choice. We're not offering an accounting choice here. We are saying for a certain set of transactions, they would follow this model, and for the other transactions would follow another model. So I think on balance, I'm more relaxed about that. And overall, thinking really about costs and benefits, on that basis, I'm happy to be in line with what staff propose and to have more than one model to deal with these transactions.
Gary.
Thank you. A few thoughts, and actually Nick said some of the ones I was going to say. I actually support the staff's recommendation, question one, that there is more than one model. But if I had to vote for a single model, honestly, I'd vote for predecessor method. And I don't think I'm going to have to have that vote. But the reason why I would is it's far and away the most common. You're getting a one-time step-up in basis. I mean, you still operate the day-to-day operations under predecessor or historical accounting principles. Whether there's always a value transfer or just some of the time, as Nick and Mary Lou, I really don't know. But what I think we've got here is two models under, you know, each one being required to be applied in a certain fact set. And the fact set is that there's basically publicly traded NCI type stuff and everything else. And so it's, I don't view, I think it's two models. It's not a general rule and an exception, because I think the exception to me is pejorative. I think the exception would far and away apply to the most transactions out there. Former Life, we did these things, if not monthly, they're done throughout the year through wholly owned subsidiaries. So if you had a one model and it was current value, you're not eliminating wholly owned subsidiaries in it. Well, if you are eliminating it, well, then you've still subdivided the set. And having two models, I don't think, as long as we're clear on where the line is, and questions two and three get us there, is maybe we only got one model in business combinations, but in share-based compensation, we have two models. And again, both are understood. If you're clear on where the line is, neither one's a problem because they're measuring different phenomena. So I support where the staff is, and we'll see where this comes out.
Constanza.
Well, I agree with most of what has been said so far. I thought we had already made the decision that the acquisition method would be the starting point in this project. So I really received that question as being, is there a case for having a second one? And the predecessor approach may be very widespread so far, I mean, in practice. At the same time, it does not arise from any IFRS requirement. So we are not we may have decisions that affect current practice and that we should not ignore, but we are not making changes to IFRS. We are bringing requirements where they do not exist, and we are bringing them as closely, in as much consistency as possible with what exists, so that in addition to all very good arguments that have been made so far.
Tadeo.
Well, I agree with the staff's proposal. I think that I agree that we have the IFRS 3 for business combination, but it's not uncommon transactions between entities under common control, selling assets and other stuff. I mean that. And we don't require these transactions to be at fair value. The point is that my experience is that sometimes we see some of these transactions with the intention just to step up assets, for example, to make some tax planning. I mean, that they are not actually a business combination in substance. And I fully agree that's quite difficult to apply the substance principle here for the transactions. But the point is that, coming back to the question one, can we just have one approach for all these transactions? I agree with the staff that, no, I think that we should have a look at these transactions and decide what would be the most appropriate approach.
Changu.
Thank you. Yes, the paper its analysis very nice, things are very comprehensive. And also, I agree that the general model is the IFRS 3 acquisition method. So it seems to me the whole transactions on the common control seems to me a kind of an exception. And based on that kind of thing, I don't want to say yes, sorry to say, on the question one, I I would say no. Just one single method, all these transactions under common control, you know, maybe as an exception maybe to the acquisition method, some other method might be a good idea. So that's the kind of a response on the question one. And two other comments I have. First one is in future meetings, you are going to bring some issue on how to be a predecessor method and counterparty method. But once I wrote in your paper, you are going to also bring some issues of the fair value model or acquisition method in practice, maybe some abuse, you know, some scandals. If we use the acquisition method, fair value method, on this business combination, the common control, I guess that's one of the many items you are going to bring us. So I'm just wondering whether you are still you still have that kind of plan to bring us some kind of some problems with the acquisition method when it's applied to.
I'm not sure I fully understand, Chungu, what you are alluding to. So what we said before is a question we are going to ask the board, whether the board thinks acquisition method as set out in IFRS 3 should in some way be modified for business combinations under common control, or whether it should be applied as it stands. And then the other question is, should there be any additional disclosures for business combinations under common control that are not required today for business combinations? So these are the questions and the analysis that we are planning to bring to the board.
Okay, so you are not going to bring some practical cases that are caused by this kind of acquisition method that applied to their business combination under common control. In many countries, they might have some kind of problems because they allowed to those companies to use a fair value method to recognize all fair values of assets and liabilities. Even they could recognize some big amount of goodwill because of they could apply this acquisition method on this business combination, the common control. So that's the only concern we have. A major concern on this kind of accounting on this business combination, the common control. And also that's why I'm saying, in a kind of a legal contract, we say this is a kind of a type of business combination, but some other people are saying this is kind of just an internal restructuring. This is not a business combination at all. If you see the substance of this kind of combination, legally it's okay. It's a kind of business combination. So we think this is a type of a business combinations we apply. So the acquisition method in principle, that kind of approach is there. But as Nick said, if this kind of a transaction, business combination under common control, is different from the normal business combination. So even the name is the same, but the substance is different, then we might need a totally different accounting for these different transaction. So that's the what maybe.
If I understand your question correctly, if you are talking about sort of the fact that different business combinations under common control can be more like a normal acquisition versus some business combinations under common control are not acquisitions, as set out in IFRS 3. We have already presented that analysis to the board in June, and our argument in the June paper pretty much was, if you have non-controlling shareholders in the receiving entity, from the point of view of those owners, of those shareholders, a business combination under common control is an acquisition, because as a result of this transaction, the shareholders acquire economic interest in the transferred assets. In contrast, if it is transaction between wholly owned entities, above the receiving entity, there are no shareholders that acquire economic interest in the transferred assets. So the controlling party, their economic interest, not just control, but also their economic interest is unchanged. So that was the analysis and the conclusion we presented to the board back in June.
Can I have a go at answering what I think Chinwu's question might be? I think it's not that we're thinking of cases where there might be abuses through the use of the acquisition method. I think it's, if I remember correctly, the issue we need to look at is what happens if there's a possibility that the transaction wasn't an exchange of equals. Mm-hmm. And in that case, do we look for contributions or distributions, and what do we do in those cases? I think that's the issue we're looking at.
Yeah. So that's a question about whether to modify the acquisition method or not.
First of all, I agree with where we are, but we're going to go with a discussion paper, and I just wanted to think about some things that we may want to ask. And in particular, I think it's just the as you go down the decision tree, I think it says if you have no non-controlling shareholders, then it's a predecessor. But if it's yes, if they're publicly traded, you go to current value. If it's not publicly traded, you ask some other questions. If they're all related parties, you say predecessor. If they're
two.
What?
To be clear,
no, I'm just summarizing.
Yeah.
It's okay. And then you come down to the non-controlling shareholders, and then if you inform them and they're silent, it's predecessor, and if you inform them they object, it's current value. And so I think my understanding is that the precedent for this kind of a structure is in IFRS 10. And so one of the things, if we're doing the discussion paper, is a plan to kind of get some evidence about how well that's working.
So quite likely for, and again, this is a question two, to be honest, but just to answer what you said, Tom. So post-implementation review on IFRS 10 is starting now, is about to start. And so according to the sort of current timeline, we will be getting feedback on implementation of IFRS 10 in time for the board's re-deliberating the discussion paper on business combination and the common control. So if there are any practical questions related to the existing exemption in IFRS 10, we will hear about it. But that's question two, so maybe if we can discuss it separately and have a vote on question one first.
Okay, sorry about that.
Jen Chow.
Thank you, Hans. I just make my point clearer. As I said, that because the question asked that whether we should propose a single approach to apply all the transactions, because as I said, maybe there are some exceptions, but we should make clear what's the general model for those BCUCC based on the nature of the BCUCC. A couple of points I would like to make, because based on the question two and three, because if we develop, there's not single approach, that means we have to develop more than single approach to apply those different approaches for different scenarios. And those different scenarios should work for, should operational. But after I work through all the examples, all the suggestions, I feel maybe there will be many practical issues come out based on our distinctions. For example, currently we decide different approach for those companies. If those companies, they are listed companies, they should be using current value approach. If not, they should be using they're required to using a precessor method. And for example, there is a company, first half year, this is non-listed company. They have not yet listed, but they undertake a BCUC transaction. So of course, according to our suggestion, they should be using precessor method. And suppose there is no NCI for this company, but since July 1st, it become listed company. So, and then the second half year, the company undertook another BCUC transaction. And then, of course, because it's listed, they got NCI. And of course, that transaction should be using current value approach. So when the company prepare this year's annual report, they got two BCUC transactions there. First, because they have to disclose accounting policies for BCUC transaction. But exactly similar or same BCC transactions, they got two accounting policies there and two different accounting approaches there. So we should be think very carefully how the company to communicate to the investors, because exactly similar transaction there, they got different accounting treatment simply because it is listed or non-listed, but nature is similar or same. So this kind of practical issue, we should first think about that. If there is no better solution, let's think about, first think about what kind of general approach we should have. And then, so this is the point I would like to make. Actually, there are a lot of practical issues that come out. For example, if the receiving entity is a listed company, and the receiving entity got a subsidiary, such as receiving entity A, the name is A, and the company has got B, B is the subsidiary of A is non-listed company. And at the same year, receiving entity acquire a subsidiary controlled by parent. And the B, that's the subsidiary of receiving entity, also acquire another subsidiary from controlled by the parent. It also will result in different accounting treatment for similar BCUCC transactions. So in this case, I think if we develop, if we cannot soundly develop some kind of, you know, distinguish for different scenarios to apply a different accounting treatment, I think we should be carefully. We decided that, okay, we needed to develop a different kind of approaches. Simply just that we draw your bright line for different scenarios. This is, I think, one thing I really worry about that. And secondly, as I think Mary mentioned about what's the difference and what's the commonality between BCUCC and the regular business combination. I think if we look at, of course, there is a business combination, no problem, but this is the commonality. But I think we should look at why it's different. Other standards, if the receiving entity buy an asset from another subsidiary controlled by the parent. Simply assets. The receiving entity buy a chair from that company. It's no problem. I think normally the parents will not step in to direct what the price you should set and why, what kind of transaction arrangement you should do. But once the receiving entity acquire a company controlled by the parent, normally it's with so-called the nature is changed, because this is really common control transaction. And normally, the parents will direct both entities, you guys should merge it together, and what price you should agree on, and other things. I think the nature is different compared business combination with acquire a single asset, I think it's different. So I always think that what kind of approach, maybe predecessor or current value approach, I always think that starting point should look at the nature of the BCUCC, whether there is a commonality or whether it's different. If the difference is such substantial, whether we should develop different approach, with the IFRS 3 approach. So this is the point I really would like to make, and then to avoid some further practical issues if we approach further.
Yeah.
Daryl. The thing I was going to say, and I think this discussion is probably outside of the scope of this question and probably even this paper, but I suspect a lot of the problems that you're concerned about may well exist in the current environment. So you can have in the same set of an account an acquisition from a non-common control entity, an acquisition from a common control entity, and you would account for them differently. You can have change in common control during the current period where you would account for it before and afterwards differently. And you could have a common control transaction or two common control transactions, one in which the holding company has exercised their ability to control the price that's happened, and one that's on pure economic terms. So I suspect what you're worried about is actually already exists in the current circumstance, but I'd say it's probably outside of where we are thinking at the moment.
Question one. Yeah, I'm going to have, we're going to take a look at the heat. I don't think it's because of the argument, but it's really okay, except in the case of Jian Chao. But he still has his jacket on. It's amazing. All right, who supports the staff's recommendation? All right. Can we...
So that takes us to question two.
Two, yes, sorry.
So maybe just, again, very quickly to tee up, just question two. So the way we have approached it and the way we're thinking about it, that really, if you have non-controlling shareholders, chances are transaction is an acquisition and non-controlling shareholders need current value information. So this is the principle. But then the question is, how do we take into consideration the cost constraint? And we think it's not an obstacle for listed entities, can be an obstacle for private entities, and we propose an exemption and an exception from current value for private entities for that reason, to address cost constraint. With that, I...
Okay, Nick.
So in principle, I agree with the staff's proposal, which is set out in question two. And the reason I say that, what I'm struggling with is here we're still talking about a current value approach.
Based on
the acquisition method, rather than having any specifics around that. And so I would be happy to agree to question two, but on that basis that we come back to that in a future meeting. And just to flag some things to think about as we come back to discuss what that a current value approach might be. I think for me there are three issues for consideration. One is the information needs of equity investors that we haven't considered in detail. We've looked at the equity interest requires of creditors and other lenders. We've considered new or potential equity investors. The second one clearly is cost issues, which we've talked about already throughout this discussion. And the third one, which may actually capture all of these, which for me is most important, is to consider the revisions to the conceptual framework. So through that process, we looked again at definitions of various elements, particularly assets and liabilities. And I would be particularly interested to understand, as you know, we're in a journey going towards some standard setting, where any of our proposals would diverge from the revised conceptual framework. So on the understanding of those issues, I'm happy to support staff proposal in question two.
Be happy. Tadeo.
Well, I support the staff proposal. The only thing that I would... I know that IFRS 10, we have the exception that all shareholders, including those without the right to vote, to agree not preparing consolidated financial statements. I think that consolidated financial statements is presentation, transparency. Here, we are talking about stepping up the value of assets, recognizing intangibles that otherwise wouldn't be recognized. I think it is a much more huge impact in accounts of a company. And let's say that we have a negligible NCI saying no. Because of this negligible NCI, I mean that the company will have to make the transaction at fair value, at current value. I think that we should, and at least I wish that if we are able to deal with a situation where as we have in some of capital markets, such as when you are closing the capital of a company, it's almost impossible to get 100% of the shareholders agreeing with that. And then there is a limit. When you achieve that limit, you are able to close the capital. I think that here we might, and I'm just thinking, whether we can develop a principle that could deal with some exceptions to avoid what I say, calling here, negligible NCI, that we are giving too much power to decide about the accounting of the company.
I could maybe quickly respond to this. So we have thought about that, and we also agree that, of course, here we're talking an exemption from measurement, whereas in IFRS 10 it's dealing with the exemption from essentially presentation. We think on balance trying to establish some sort of quantitative threshold expressed in qualitative term probably will create more drawbacks than benefits. And in particular, there are already many various terms in IFRS standards that relate either to probability or significance. And this creates challenges in practice. It creates challenges in terms of translation, interpretation, and it does not really result in consistent, does not necessarily always result in consistent application. For that reason, we would like to avoid any sort of vague term. We do recognize that, yes, in some circumstances, a private entity that would like to apply the exemption would not be able to apply an exemption, but I think as staff, we're sort of willing maybe to take that cost as opposed to introducing vague term in the discussion paper. And I suppose we see this exemption as a gift to a company. And yes, in some cases they will not be able to use it, but then we hope that in many cases they would be able to use it. And finally, as we already discussed with Storm, so IFRS 10 that uses similar exemption is about to have a post-implementation review, and if there is any feedback coming as part of that post-implementation review, which we could use here, of course we will consider it and we would bring it to the board.
Martin.
And I agree also in principle, but I'm not fine with this last thing here, which is that you have asked the minority shareholders of a private entity if they not object, because I think it is first difficult in practice to do, because if you have a company, you have to write to all your minority shareholders and then wait, maybe give a time limit where they object of that, but then at least maybe some single guy who can then select or can not object to that or object and then determines the accounting of his company of an acquisition. I think that is not a good rule. And I agree to all of that, but not for the last part, because I think then if there is a private entity, if they have minority shareholders of substance, they should then also apply the current value approach. So I would stop to have this kind of position tree with the before the last and say all others have to be then used current.
Does it mean, Martin, if we were to remove that exemption, if we were to say that private entities are required to apply current value approach unless all shareholders are related parties, so that would then mean if I have just one shareholder with a negligible share, I would still have to apply a current value approach?
Yeah, so this always meant if you have a kind of fixing something and then, decide which model you should apply. It's always at the ranges of the box you have this kind of cases. And I would recommend that, because otherwise, I understand why you are doing that, but I think it is difficult, first, in practice to do that. And secondly, I think it's also not the correct outcome, because then maybe if you have 100 minority shareholders and one think, it is not a good thing, and then, company has to do that, is the same kind of extreme situation. I can come up with also that example. Then this one shareholder say, the company has to do current value. Even 99 of the other shareholders think, this as a method is okay. For two reasons, I think it is. But also it's not practical, because.
Sue.
I agree with the staff recommendation, and I'm happy for this to be explored in the discussion paper. Subject to a couple of points. Firstly, I like the approach that you've proposed, because I think it's the most objective way of doing it, and I particularly like not focusing on things like the substance of the transaction and things like that, because I think we risk getting into sort of moral territory of when we think these transactions are appropriate or not, and that's not really our job. But also, I think that even if the reason is only tax, the fact that you've changed the amount of your tax bill is a substantive thing. So I like the way that you approach it. Having said that, I got a bit confused when I read the paper, and I liked your flowchart because it helped. But I think to make it even more clear, as I suggested to you guys offline, I would include another box before the final box, which is a question of whether the receiving entity wants to propose using the predecessor method, yes or no, and then just to make it clear that that one is not an automatic, which is different to the related party one, just for clarity. Now, on the, I think that the questions that we'll get and the responses we'll get if we propose this approach are going to be all around how practical this test is and the points that Martin and Tadao have been raising about, is it appropriate for one shareholder to, you know, say no and hold everybody to ransom? So I think that the thing I would be, given we've got the luxury of having a discussion paper, would be expanding on the discussion of the practicality of this and whether it should be a one person can block it or a majority or something else like that. I think that the question on practicality is a fair one, but there's other reasons why you have to contact shareholders if you're a company. This is not unique. You know, there's regulatory reasons why you need to get feedback from shareholders to make decisions on certain things. So I think we should at least raise that so it's not just a blanket, no, this isn't practical, because I'd be dubious about whether this would be unique in terms of regulatory requirements. But I think it's fair to ask, should it be everybody has to agree, or should it be a majority or something else as the filter? I don't think we need to say this has to be the filter. We can discuss whether it would be the right filter. I think the other thing when I read the paper that I sort of thought, yeah, maybe not, is I think some people might have the view that if you've got a public company with public non-controlling interests, they may have so many regulatory protections in the market because of the regulations. They may be the ones who sort of, in a way, least need this information, because they may already be protected by regulatory requirements about fairness and all of these sorts of things. So I think at least that counter-argument needs to come out in the discussion paper of whether there's a case to make that because they may, in fact, be protected by the fact that they're listed, and it may be very, very difficult to do a transaction that involves non-controlling interests that isn't on arm's length and everything because of the regulatory restrictions, that it may be appropriate to allow this option even for those who have a public non-controlling interest. I'm happy with the recommendation, but I think we just need to explore those things in the discussion paper.
Rika.
Yes. I think I agree with the staff approach to have a general approach and also have a alternative approach, and then need to draw a line in between somewhere, which is very reasonable to reflect each approach can reflect the real substance of the transaction or business combination. So I don't disagree with that idea, but I am still struggling with using the definition of related parties to draw this line to require the specific approach. Because what I said is when I read the paper, especially paragraph 36, and we have some assumption that related parties may not rely on the entity's financial statement for meeting their information needs. But in practice, there are a variety of related parties. Some cases, they have a right access to the real information that meets their needs, but sometimes they don't. Almost impossible for them to get the real information they really need. So I think using this concept to draw the line is still have a question about that. Do you have any backup to, this is a light criteria to get the right target to apply the specific approach?
Again, what we proposed in relation to related parties is not sort of an ideal solution. And we fully agree that in some cases, those related parties essentially could be an extension of the parent, an extension of the controlling party, and they don't either don't need this information or they would have access to this information. Whereas in other cases, related parties can be in a position where they do need this information. So it's not an ideal approach. But we think on balance, again, it's getting us closer to the target population of providing useful information where it's necessary at a cost justified by the benefits. Also, just sort of a bit of a background, related parties as a condition is considered in the definition of investment entity in IFRS 10. So it's not something entirely new that we propose in this paper.
Jan Chow.
Thank you, Hans. First of all, I agree with and Martin and Sue mentioned, and also I think Rick also mentioned whether those related party notion and those NCI's views, whether they would like to apply predecessor approach or not. I think we should test whether it's in practice it's really workable or not, including the related party notion. Because here we mention the related parties of the receiving entity, not the relationship between those related parties. I think what intention actually we are looking at whether all those related parties will jointly influence those, you know, decision-making process, involving those decision-making process. I think this is another dimension what we should focus on. We should make it clear. Simply say, they are all related parties, but they do have no internal relationship between those among them. I don't think it makes sense in this case. So I hope that we can explore further. Secondly, come to the next point about equity investors. You know whether I think we did a very good job to reach out to those creditors. But what's the information needs from those equity investors? Because we focus on those these companies. I think they got numerous, you know, equity investors. So what's the information? What they need? I think we should need to explore further, especially if we introduce the current value approach to explore. Giving a very simple example. I think from my point of view, maybe they need two information. One is they really need a current value information, no problem. When the receiving entity decide to acquire another business, they really need to know what's the assets, the liability you acquired, what's the value of those assets and the liability it is. I think this kind of information, this is the information at the acquisition date. And whether it should be on a balance sheet or could be disclosed in notes and also can meet those investors' needs. Secondly, what they need, as we developed at the goodwill and impairment project, actually they would like to know the subsequent performance after the acquisition, after the BCUCC transaction, whether they really reached the expected target. For example, as I say, if the receiving entity acquire another business, and the receiving entity is the product is manufacture the tables, and that acquired business is manufacture the chairs, and before the acquisition, the cost of the chair, maybe per chair is £100, and they expect after acquisition, because they can enjoy the synergies further, they expect the cost will lower, maybe £80, so and that £20 can really provide value-added information to the equities whether acquisition is successful or not, in particular for those business combination under common control, because parents know before all the business before the acquisition, after that there is a clear strategy there. But if we introduce a current value approach, maybe the case is not, because the subsequent performance, maybe the cost, because you have to depreciate all those PPEs based on current value. So maybe the cost will become 120, not 80. So I'm not sure that information really meets the needs of the users. So this is, I think, this first question we should look at. Second, what kind of because after we introduce the current value approach, we have to recognize the company recipients have to recognize goodwill. And this is also different because BCUCC normally the business acquired, actually before the acquisition, they already enjoyed some certain of the synergies, such as they share the same brand, they share the same technology center, they share the same design, something like that. So when the receiving entity buy that business, price that business, or that price already including some kind of synergy before the acquisition, and all those value will go to goodwill after acquisition. I'm not sure that goodwill is really acquired goodwill, or that is part of the goodwill, actually is internally generated goodwill, because it's already there before. And then we realize the internally generated goodwill. Is it faithfully represented your economics and provide useful information for users? So this kind of thing I'm struggling and worried about. Maybe this is really difference between BCUCC and normal regulated business combination.
Darryl?
So broadly supportive of the direction you're taking. A couple of questions and specific things. I think Nick picked up on one of the questions I had. If I start firstly on the first category, which I'd say is those subsidiaries where the outside shareholders are listed, is liquid listed equity holdings. For me, the reason why I would be very supportive of that is because I want to see commonality of accounting for companies that are BCs, are under business, under common control, and those that are not. So I think if we're talking about, when we talk about the current value approach based on the acquisition method, I'm assuming that based on the acquisition method is about providing additional guidance with how to deal with the transaction rather than creating what might be a bespoke third model. So I have acquisition, I have predecessor, and I have something that lives in between. That, to me, defeats the purpose of why I'd be supportive of that. So I think just to make that point, I think just given some of the discussion around the table, I think it's probably worth also emphasizing that the transactions we're talking about can occur in a number of different circumstances. So to one of Jean Charles' points, I'm definitely aware of circumstances where completely unrelated companies are under the common control of a single individual owner. So they don't have commonality of brand, they don't have commonality of any of those things, and I think we just need to bear in mind that sometimes we fall into the trap of thinking about very specific transaction types or pre-existing things. There are a number of different ones out there. Then on the have been informed about and do not object to, the way that I read those words is that I notify my shareholders that this is what I'm going to do, and if I hear nothing back, I assume they agree with it. So I'm not looking for agreement. I'm actually looking to see if anyone disagrees, and I think that's a much lower hurdle than requiring agreement. And I think it's just worth emphasizing that in the discussion we have. And then the third point I wondered about was whether the related party requirements are actually redundant. And I think it might be something we want to test in a discussion paper. And the reason I say that is that if they are all related parties, then it's much easier to achieve the have been informed about and do not object. And so are we adding an extra complication in here that you have to go through an assessment when it would be just much easier to meet 37B and not even think about 37A.
Councilor Bowser.
Well, I'm supportive of the proposal, the recommendation of the staff and of the analysis leading to it. So on a number of points that have been made so far, on the practicality issue, as I think Julia has already pointed out in her comment, I think this is an additional possibility of not getting to the current value approach. So if you encounter a practical difficulty, you would be in the same place as you would if that had not been introduced. So to me, it's making things easier eventually. So And the other comment I would have is about eventually the link to regulatory protection that NCI may have. I would see them play a role probably more in the why, whether there is a need for amending the acquisition method rather than deciding what method to apply. Because, first of all, because these regulatory protections may vary in content from jurisdiction to jurisdiction, and if they have a complete set of information, they would be more keen to disclosures than they would be to accounting. And I think in deciding that the current value approach should be the starting point, we have acknowledged that accounting had to be was superior to disclosures only. So for these reasons, I can see them play a role, but more in the way the acquisition method is applied.
Gary. Thank you. But, I agree with the staff's recommendation. I think it's a rational place to be using the definitions that we've got in IFRS 10 and perhaps elsewhere as well. But like many of the others, I think we still need to ask the question about opt-in or opt-out or affirmative response or negative response. And, up till now, the discussion has been about must they respond unanimously, but there's a whole host of sub-issues there. What if you can't find the person? For example, I can assure you that can be the case. Or what if they're a juvenile and they can't speak for themselves, or they're incapacitated, or it's in charge? But these are real issues.
Rules for all of these.
No, but the point is it's not the end of the world if you get a fair value accounting with one person disagrees, yeah. But there should probably be some practical de minimis test. As long as we ask it in the discussion paper, I'm fine with recommending with how we do it today is to go in and see if it works.
Mary. Mary has a couple of rules for us.
No, I just have a couple comments on things that Daryl said. One is I wanted to strongly agree with one of them, which is that when we talk about a current value based on the acquisition method, that we're thinking about maybe tuning rather than a bespoke method. I'd been at least assuming that, but that is, I think, an important assumption on my part to me. And the second is Daryl was questioning, and I'm looking at the, I agree, very helpful flow chart, whether we need the penultimate box of are all non-controlling shareholders related party of the receiving entity, because he thought that the last box would deal with that. I think that test is there for a different purpose. I mean, it might help with the last box, but I think it's there for a different purpose, because I think it goes to some of the accounting arbitrage concerns about could you, in effect, get, if you were looking to get fair value, current value accounting, could you get it by creating some NCI, let's say, with a related party? And so the point was that if the whole NCI is related party, then you are forced by, as you see in this graph, off to predecessor rather than it being an option. So I think those are two independent ideas rather than the last box being a proxy for the third.
Okay. Can I see if we can support the staff's recommendation?
Eleven.
Final question.
The final question is whether you agree that a predecessor method should be required for all remaining transactions within the scope of the project.
I think we implicitly agree, right?
Okay. Sorry, can I just make one? And now Mary's just thrown a ball, so I'm having to think through this related party one. So when I originally read this, I wondered if the way I'd been thinking about it is that we'd been setting up the predecessor approach as something of an expedient. So it was because we felt that in that circumstance, the cost and benefit argument weren't satisfied, and I wondered whether we wanted to explore required versus permitted. But I think with Mary having said what she's just said,
call it a doubt in the back of my mind, but I'm now not so sure about what I was thinking originally.
Okay, can we support the staff's recommendation? Tadeo, sorry.
Just one comment, as it's going to become a discussion paper, just to explore the definition of predecessor account.
Of course, it's coming, and it's coming. Your wish, careful what you wish for.
Can we support the staff's recommendation?
It's unanimous.
Yes.
Uh-huh. All right. Well done. Yeah, let's have a short break till 11. Thank you.